And you're listening to Solar Powered Crew FM. Welcome to Inside the Headlines with news vandal JP Sotilli. Do we have you on the line there?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I was just polishing up my trumpet.
Well, yes, I guess we need to start there. I have to say, I'm kind of in this mode of ostrich-headed duck down. Oh, my godness, do I have to really look at this? And, of course, being part of the news, we do. And that's why, boy, I'm beholden to you.
I was actually watching a little bit of the Red State confab. Red State is by Eric Erickson. It's a website, hard right-wing blogger who's become a bit of a tastemaker among the Tea Party set and also among traditional right-wing Republicans, not the establishment Republicans. And so they've got a big confab, and, you know, everybody is trying to, from the last night's debate, is going down there trying to leverage their performance into a little bit more buzz and a little bit more traction. By the way, Trump now at 34% in the latest poll in Georgia, dwarfing the next contender, which would be Jeb Bush at, I think, 12%.
Wow.
Walker at 10%, which is interesting, considering what I thought was, by my assessment, a very lackluster performance on the part of Trump. But putting that aside, we'll get to that. You know, one of the things that I try to do is watch things that people find distasteful. It's it's what I'm supposed to do, and it's something I started very early in my life when I developed an affinity for watching televangelists starting age 8 or 9. If you want to know what Limburger tastes like, you have to eat it.
I'm beholden to you. My hat's off to you. I do a fair amount of it for different subjects, but sometimes it just, look, these guys are all humans and good people inside or whatever, and they all mean well. And
some don't. Some do. Look, I'm willing to be, I am not affiliated with a party. I've not been affiliated with a party my entire adult life, really, particularly my professional life. Jim Lehrer, and I think we've had this discussion in the past, Jim Lehrer, when I worked at the NewsHour, he actually believed that to be an effective journalist, you should not only not be registered with a political party, you shouldn't vote. That actually the act of journalism is your vote in a democracy. That's how important journalism is to a democracy and how important it is to be divorced from the parties involved in democracy. I actually kind of agree with that, to be honest with you. And I feel like I have, when I make it a statement, because I don't have a dog in the fight. And I think that's an important thing. You know, I look at Carl Cameron, for example. He is the political reporter, a national political correspondent for Fox News, has been for a long time. And his wife is a political consultant who was working for the Romney campaign. Now, you could say that, look, that's, she's her own person and these are two separate entities, but come on. How about now you have Chris Matthews? Now, Chris Matthews is slightly different because he's not a political reporter. He's actually a commentator. Now, Chris Matthews, his wife is running for Kathleen Matthews, who, by the way, I used to produce Kathleen Matthews. She was one of the anchors on my show. She's running for Congress and she's buying ads on networks. So these are two separate things, I think. When you have Carl Cameron, who's a national political reporter, and his wife is helping Republican candidates run for election, and he's covering those candidates, that is a major problem. It's a little bit squishier on the Chris Matthews side, but still, ultimately, Chris Matthews used to work for Tip O'Neill, and he flipped the script and went from actively involved in politics to supposedly being in journalism and really being more of a commentator, but it's all confusing in today's environment. I think that is part of why we have two things. One, we have the groaning malaise that you just expressed and that so many people express about politics, and on the other hand, also why Trump has so much traction, because he is not market-tested. He is not part of some squishy gray area between media and politics and business and politics. I mean, on some levels, if you dig deeply, he kind of is, and that became part of the debate, and part of the attacks on him were his past links with the Democratic Party, with the Clintons in particular, with being pro-choice, with being in favor of single-payer health care, and then flipping to the other side because he wants to run for the nomination, but ultimately the clarity of his tone is what sets him apart from this Carl Cameron-y, Chris Matthews-y, market-tested, Hillary Jeb Bush measured way of doing things.
Well, it's a great point. Again, just sounding different makes you seem different. But, you know, the fact that we're even splitting straws like this is such a symptom or, I don't know what, of decline of, and, you know, I sound like everybody else, how pitiful it all is. And I don't mean to do that, but you think, JP, you look at what's happening and who's doing well. I mean, gotcha politics, gotcha anything, gotcha interviews, not my favorite stuff. You know, Michael Moore has a new movie he's been working on quietly coming out on the military-industrial complex. You know, he's kind of a gotcha, set somebody up and take them down thing.
Well, James, you probably have the same reaction I had to him ambushing Charlton Heston, who was obviously suffering the effects of Alzheimer's at that time. And that knocked Michael Moore down a notch with me. I don't know what you thought about that.
Well, you know, you get going for the point that at anybody's expense. I think that wasn't a good moment for him. I think he's done some great work elsewhere, put shining lights where people don't like light shined, and also doing it with humor, which is something, you know, I guess we'll quickly say in this prequel to the week that was that John Stewart stepping down, you know, maybe been a little lackluster of late. And this final week, he brought the comedians in, and, you know, Schumer, I think it was just a nice, obviously he's a little bit feeling it and he will be missed. He brought some good attention a lot of different places. I saw an article on Palestinians in particular and some very marginalized people that had at least a little bit of a nod and an affirmation in some ways, saying they're going to miss John Stewart. And I think I'll just say this, it's been a show, very few television shows that I've even paid attention to, honestly, in the last several decades, and that has been a pretty constant source of at least some kind of barometer of what's happening, what's going down. It'll be interesting to see what, I mean, Colbert, the role he's going to be in, I can't imagine will continue. We'll see how this new host does. I actually have some hope for that, but it's, you know, to get that kind of personal relationship, tribute to John Stewart, I have to say, Chuck Schumer deciding to go against the Iran deal as the, well, I think he's the most senior Jewish senator, possibly up for, you know, taking things over. I don't think his finest moment, this decision. It's interesting that he waited till Stewart was done. I'm sure it just by chance or whatever, but he's related to Amy Schumer, but it's no joke. Made me think of Tom Daschle deciding to go along with Bush.
Well, you want to just jump right into that? Because, I mean, we can talk about, I mean, the debate is the debate. We kind of said what we're going to say. Ultimately, my assessment of it was everybody seems to be in love with Rubio. I can tell you the Weekly Standard is he is the neoconservatives, and that's a dovetail to the next topic you're talking about, Daschle.
Yep.
You know, he's the neoconservative choice, which is one of the reasons why I think he might be perhaps the most frightening if you're not interested in war. If you're interested in war, he's probably a go-to choice. But I think when I looked at the debate, what I heard was Trump is there to stay because of the reasons we talked about earlier. Christie sounds the most rational and the most like a grown-up, and he's probably every day ruining Bridgegate that he ever let that happen, whether or not he did or, you know, how connected he was. But that damaged him because I think he would be a front runner without it because of the clarity and the policy heavy presentation that he gives. Jeb Bush comes across that way, but I think that there's Bush fatigue inside the Republican Party, and he's experiencing it. My dark horse is John Kasich, and I think that Kasich is going to do very well in New Hampshire. He's kind of that perfect New Hampshire candidate. And then a lot of people celebrating Carly Fiorina. And in the you can't make this stuff up category, Fiorina, who went very hard at Hillary Clinton, Jeb Bush, in the what's called the undercard debate, the first debate where the second tier of candidates got together and she stood out from the rest of them, which I think is probably not very hard. I'm just going to say that. I'm sorry, Bobby Jindal. I mean, just Bobby Jindal. Rick Santorum again. My goodness, my friend. Anyway, she happened to have left her closing statement on the printer in the hotel room on her way to the debate. There's some interesting HP karma there. And by the way, let's just – I would like to get your thought on this too. I think that the biggest loser was Rand Paul. He looks sad to me. He looks like a man who has transgressed his base, his libertarian values, given up on the thing that differentiated himself from the field, that made him attractive to, like his father was attractive to folks there in Fairfield and the surrounding towns in the county, and made him attractive to a number of young people from across the political spectrum. And there he was last night, just saying things that he would not have said a year ago and saying them with no conviction and looking pretty meager in the process.
Well, you know, my quick thought is that, you know, Trump stole the night with, what, 10 and a half minutes or 11, whatever it was. I mean, people talking that quickly, that many people. The big winner, I think someone pointed out earlier, Fox News, for making this into something rather than these guys having to get out and go to the as much to where the ground is made up, turning all this stuff more into that level of debate. And, you know, they've got it. They'll probably do it every year or whatever.
But don't you think that Megyn Kelly seemed to have had an agenda to try and knock Trump on his feet a little bit? She came at him hard on misogyny. About him calling women fat pigs and dogs and slobs and disgusting animals, some of which was in reference to a sort of a Twitter war that he got involved with Rosie O'Donnell. There seemed to be, and some of the analysis I'm seeing is that there is a bit of an idea that Fox has it in there somewhere among the group of moderators there that they kind of wanted to go at Trump a little bit.
Well, you know the history with Rupert Murdoch. Hates Trump. Trump hates...
But Roger Ailes doesn't.
Well, yeah. Oh, there you go. I mean, we have an interesting...
I know you... This is just... It is befuddling, isn't it?
Well, it's just, to me, Trump, in a nutshell, no pun intended, or pun intended, I'm not sure, but at any rate... It represents what Citizen United has created. You know, you get the big guys, 400 families, stoking half the campaign chests of all the candidates, each of them with their own billionaire and so forth. Well, if you're your own billionaire, it's just he's actually a harbinger of things to come if we keep this system. There'll be a bunch of few rich people, Berlusconi, Trump, whoever. They're going to get up there. They like the sound of their voice. They think they can do it, and they talk no nonsense. I mean, people will actually, JP, have to listen to what's being said and then see if what's being said matches with what they've done before, and if it matches with what they've done before, are they able to work with people? All those things that maybe if the country survives, will be good in the long run. And, boy, I have to tell you, this start into the game – to me, more than anything, reflects a really unruly group of on the right that are really finding their way. And just as we get into the week that was, we kind of covered the first topic anyway. Some great stuff, as always. I just wanted to give a tip of the hat to one of our former co-hosts and show hosts here, Ari Berman, who was at the 50th celebration of voting rights, at the White House, president and others there. His new book is out, Give Us the Ballot. It's doing very well. He's just written for The Atlantic and New York Times op-ed. He's been, you know, one of the leading champions of this critical issue. 15 states this year now, for the first time in presidential elections, have made it tougher. And he's got his highlight on that. But what a great honor for him, I know, and also really for all of us coming from Fairfield and being a part of that critical issue. And that's another kind of backdrop to all this stuff that's going on there. But Ari, we love you. He was here for maybe a year and a half, and a very articulate voice, I have to say, writes for The Nation and
constantly on the voting rights issue. That's his issue. I mean, this is what he knows backwards and forwards.
Yeah, and it's you know, it's not a pretty picture. And I just wanted to mention Kasich, his state, Bush, his state, when he was governor, kind of all of a sudden, very hands-on, Ari said on Democracy Now, very hands-on governor. Jeb Bush. But all of a sudden, when it came to this weird stuff with his brother and all that purging that went on.
Yeah, Catherine Harris, 50,000 voters.
But
purged.
It's all Catherine Harris. He had nothing to do with it. You know,
right.
That is.
Well, you know who else was involved with that, by the way? One.
Cruz.
Joe Scarborough.
Oh, okay.
And he was a representative. And Joe Scarborough's secretary died under mysterious circumstances after that happened. And Joe Scarborough quickly resigned from Congress and ended up getting a very nice career as a television personality.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the thing with Bush, that's when you hear about those names, how it was done and the numbers again, you know, you kind of forget about it. You move on. You don't want to think about it. But then it's like, wait, those people, this issue, that close, this thing, holy mackerel. Anyway, let's get into it. Well, let's go to rinse, repeat. How about that?
Yep. What do you got there?
Well, we've got something that is quite amazing, I have to say. I mean, I know about the Kagans, and I know about the Project for New American Century, William Crystal, all this stuff, but holy mackerel, what has come out now, the day after 9/11, the day after Kagan and Frederick Kagan, brother of Robert Kagan, we'll get into this, I'll let you, but they wanted to take the war, who, where? Well, these guys have been pushing for going to war with Iraq since 98, 3 years before 9/11. The day after, they didn't want to just do that. They thought it's time to take the war to Palestine. Unbelievable.
Yeah, and said, we need to go at these, take the war to these people. You know, these people, that's generally a red flag there. Also, interestingly, talking about, well, what if these attackers have anthrax? A strange portent of what was to come. This is all the day after. Also saying things like, well, there are so many groups there in the Middle East. It doesn't really matter which of those groups was responsible for 9/11.
Unbelievable.
We should take out all of the groups because, hey, it really, ultimately, we're at war with all of them anyway.
And by the way, I'm sorry to interrupt, but JP, they're talking about, they were asked, do you mean Hamas?
Hamas, Hezbollah.
No, but do you mean Arafat, PA? They said Arafat. They said PA.
They said, they didn't say we need to clean out the occupied territories, and Arafat included in that clean out. And also talking about putting boots on the ground. They wanted a boots on the ground, U.S.-led invasion of the occupied territories. Yeah. To clean out these groups. And look, there are reasons to bring this up. One is because this is rinse repeat, and the second article is about Obama's much ballyhooed at the beginning of the week, but really little discussed after it happened, speech at American University that was supposed to be reminiscent of Kennedy's grand speech,
right.
1963, where he basically called for peace. In the world, making peace with the Soviet Union, understanding that the Soviet Union they need to breathe the same air that Americans breathe. They live on the same planet. Maybe it's time for something new. Those of us who believe that Kennedy was murdered by the military-industrial complex will point to that as maybe the final straw, the final nail in that coffin, because it did seem that he was ready to make peace after the Cuban Missile Crisis and things that had happened. Obama's speech, I watched it, listened to it. It was not really JFK's American University speech. It really was more of a sort of a long laundry list defense of the deal, which I'm not criticizing. That has to happen. But it didn't really stir the soul the way the American University speech did. But what he did do in that speech is talk about the lead up to the Iraq war and the kinds of thinking and the kinds of propaganda, and I'm using that word propaganda, folks. It was propaganda. I'm sorry, James, you knew, I knew, the folks at McClatchy knew, everybody knew that the weapons of mass destruction, not everybody, but the people that looked at it closely knew that the weapons of mass destruction charges that became the false pretense under which Iraq was invaded were completely bogus. I personally believe, and this is just, I say believe, I don't know, because we don't have a smoking gun. Although I have to tell you, I look at during the California energy crisis, this is before 9/11, the fact that Dick Cheney went into an energy commission meeting with oil maps of Iraq seems to me not to maybe be a smoking gun, but boy, it sure is great circumstantial evidence, including all of the warnings that were sort of strangely ignored in the lead up to 9/11, that they knew what they wanted and they knew where they were going. And I think this is what the brothers Kagan, along mm-hmm. with Father Kagan and Victoria Nuland,
yes.
who I've written about, who is married to one of the Kagan clan and who I believe was sort of ginning up what was going on in the Ukraine and her connections to the Freedom House, to the big ag corporations that have been eyeing getting into Ukraine for years. I wrote about that about a year ago. You know, that these folks saw immediately in 24 hours an opportunity to clean all the houses that they've wanted to clean throughout most of their adult lives. And these are the folks who have driven neocon foreign policy. These are folks who, by the way, if you talk about Elliot Abrams and Wolfowitz and Richard Perle, these guys go back to the 70s, to the rewriting of the National Intelligence Estimate in 1976, mm-hmm. when George Herbert Walker Bush was head of the CIA. That National Intelligence Estimate initially said, hey, you know, it doesn't look like the Soviet Union is going to be able to invade Western Europe. It doesn't look like the Soviet Union is going to be able to do much of anything because they are collapsing like a badly made souffle in terms of their economics. They're not going to be able to do it. Well, Team B was brought in. That's Wolfowitz and Perle. And all of a sudden, the new National Intelligence Estimate said the Soviet Union is the world's leading sponsor of state terrorism. Huh, that sounds familiar. The Soviet Union is about to exceed Western military power and be able to invade Western Europe. A number of tanks and troops means that they are a existential threat to the NATO alliance. Existential threat. We've heard that before. This is 1976. What that National Intelligence Estimate led to was the Reagan military buildup. Guys like Wolfowitz, Perle, Elliot Abrams, who along with John Negroponte, who would then come to serve with the George W. Bush administration the war on under guiding huge parts of the war on terror. They were running the war in Central America. These guys have not gone away. They've had this same affectation,
mindset,
for war and conquest and for extending America's empire. They like the word empire. They're not afraid of empire.
Mindset, and, too. M-I-N-E.
Yeah, mindset. They love to set minds. It's, look, when you think about this milieu and what President Obama is up against in terms of selling his deal, this is why the Schumer thing, many think, is important, because Schumer, who looks to be poised to take over for Harry Reid when Harry Reid resigns, by the way, MoveOn.org is already organizing a campaign to keep Schumer from getting the Democratic leadership position, which would be the minority leadership position in the Senate. He will pay a price. And by the way, Greg Sargent, who writes the Plumb Line for Washington Post, did point out that although everybody is kind of saying, "Oh my gosh, you know, he lost Schumer. And I, even on this show a few weeks ago, said that I think Schumer is a key vote. And really, had Schumer flipped towards not being willing to override a veto, that's really what we're talking about. It's about not being willing to override a veto. You need it's 67 votes to override a veto. That's really what's going to happen. Basically, the Senate and the House is going to say, we reject the deal. Are those veto-proof? And I'm not talking about Vito Corleone, which was a great line last night that Jeb Bush used, calling himself Vito Corleone for all the bills that he vetoed. Hooray for you, Jeb. You just like to say no.
Well, I tell you what, though, this what you're talking about, too, here is, I'm not really sure when you're to this level of with Schumer, it looks like he's not clear that he's going to lead Democrats, just that he's going to do this himself or whatever. He's a hedge fund.
That's right, and he's trying to hedge a little bit with it, and that's how that, you know, they've got people who read the tea leaves, that's what they're reading in the statement, which I read, and I think that that is there, but the effect, the net effect of losing Schumer is important. Now, it's interesting, there was a report that I found in the New York Post about 8 days ago in which he was meeting with 60 prominent Jewish leaders, not named, just called prominent Jewish leaders, and apparently had a big blow-up when they were pressing him on his possible support for the Iran deal. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's a funky situation right now.
Yep.
But as Greg Sargent in the Plumline pointed out, basically, if you crunch the numbers and you look at the 14 senators who seem to be on the fence about this, and now Kristen Gillibrand, senator from New York, came out and said she's going to support the deal. Angus King, the independent from Maine, said he's going to support the deal. So there are people now who are starting to come out, and it does look like Tom Carper of Delaware and Joe Manchin of West Virginia, they are leaning towards supporting. And if that lean, these are two of the 14, if that lean happens, that will leave 12, which may mean that he's going to get – if he can – you got to pick off all 12 of those folks to get the veto to get be able to override a veto. So it may be just the when you crunch the numbers, according to Greg Sargent crunching the numbers in the Washington Post today, that it still looks okay, mostly okay, and it looks really difficult. But now you have this new thing with General Soleiman of Iran traveling against an international ban to Russia, apparently supposedly to cut an arms deal. So in some ways, and I'll just wrap it up with this, Iran is kind of holding some of the cards. And just me personally as an observer and somebody who thinks that any kind of military action against Iran is not only going to be disastrous for the Iranian people, but it's going to be disastrous in the long term, because bombing Iran is not going to be bombing Iraq. That's the thing about the Kagan brothers and Wolfowitz and Rumsfeld. All these guys knew that they were bombing one of the softest targets in the world after a decade plus of sanctions, after Saddam's army being gutted, not only by the sanctions, but initially...
Well, two-thirds of the country under fly zone.
Under fly zone. That target, that really was the like a giant 300-pound tuna in a 10-gallon barrel. That's what they were shooting in Iraq. That's not what you're going to be shooting in Iran.
Although Cotton, you know, the Iraq war veteran, he thinks, no problem, man.
A little Tommy Cottontail hopping down the Warpath Trail. I mean, every time I hear his name, I think of a Sinclair Lewis novel. There's got to be a character named Senator Tom Cotton. Anyway, let's move on.
All right. Well, thank you for that, though, because it's an important issue, and I just think the Iran demonization, Trump famously saying we should just bomb them, you know, encircle them, take the oil back, put our companies in there. What do they have left? It's like, okay, sir. Anyway, speaking of another topic that's close to your heart and your anger meter, I know, self-destructive behavior, Huntress Barbie, and who would kill a giraffe? Kind of an interesting face to this situation, isn't it?
Yeah, and the Who Would Kill a Giraffe is by – it's really quite a good article by Robin Wright. And yeah, Robin Wright, by the way, one of the world's leading English language experts on Iran and Middle East policy. And she writes for The New Yorker. And she lived for 7 years in Africa. So she wrote this really compelling essay in The New Yorker. And look, by the way, the State Department last week announced an effort to try and curtail – illicit wildlife trafficking. That's a $10 billion a year business. And oh, by the way, it's feeding terrorist groups like Al-Shabaab, things like trafficking in rhino horns, trafficking in elephant tusks. There's a massive decline in species happening right now. And I'm not talking about the sixth grade extinction as it relates to things like climate change, because that's there too. But we're talking about a massive decline in things like giraffes, right? Now, giraffes famously killed by Sabrina the Huntress from Idaho. She posted a picture on Facebook. She went out and killed a giraffe and said, oh, look at this beautiful animal that I just killed. It's so wonderful. I feel so great. Created an outrage on the heels of Cecil the Lion being killed by Walter the Killer Dentist Palmer. And, you know, I personally believe, and James, you said this is near and dear to my heart, I don't think anybody who's listened to the show has any illusions about my animal rights impulse. I do have an animal rights impulse. And when I see things like, and when really when I see Sabrina Corgitelli of this gal from Idaho posing with this picture, you know, I obviously am going to have a reaction, but I am fascinated now to see the widespread reaction, James, not just folks like me who have harbored these animal rights feelings, vegetarians and vegans, but really across the board. And this is one of the things that Robin Wright is trying to get at, is that you're talking about in the 18th century maybe a million giraffe, and now you're down to 80,000. We have a massive loss of species just from 1970 to 2010. 52% of all animals gone, 39% of terrestrial wildlife, 39% of marine wildlife, and 76% of freshwater wildlife gone from 1970 to 2010 in just 40 years. That is a staggering decline. So I think that there's, you know, things like charismatic fauna. You're talking about lions and tigers, lions like Cecil the Lion or Cecil, if you want to go with sort of a British pronunciation, which I kind of like. I think Cecil sounds really good.
Rather.
You know, those things, you know, are easily identifiable. But then there are things like pangolins, these wonderful kind of Asian armadillos that are being just wiped out right now, and they have no fear of humans. They like to walk around humans, so they're easy pickings. It's just all animals are being sort of decimated at a heady pace, and that's why Sabrina the Huntress is a bit of a marker point. And I think the reaction to her is, I think it's kind of it's good news. What do you think, James?
Well, you know what? I think the idea that we live in an ecosphere where the soil is underneath us, but part of us, where the, you know, plants, where the air, the water, the wildlife. You know, there's this idea that we're dominion. We're the, you know, we can control nature and we can harness it. And you know what? We have been able to do that. But what we don't seem capable of or very good at is balancing with nature. You know, nature's going to go on. Even if we destroy the planet or whatever happens, nature will not bat an eye in a way. But so, yeah, I mean, I just think it's interesting. I get the idea of controlled animals with the deer and all that kind of stuff and monitoring that. And there's some arguments made. I don't see how it really holds up very well when you talk about the illicit part of this. And if there is a part that's highly regulated for this type of activity, you know, that's when you get Nugent's and this lady talking about how it's this woman talking about how it's legit, it's a sport, it's all that. My brother-in-law is a hunter and sells sporting goods, and so it's not quite Satan versus Mother Mary.
Archangel Michael.
Yeah, it's not. Yeah. There's a gray area.
There is a gray area.
But the problem is where there seems not to be enough gray area when we talk about balance. And if you're going to do something, we wouldn't be talking about these things the way we are if we hadn't gotten to the point we are. And that's why I think it's the healthy part of the discussion is, what are we doing to our planet? What should we be doing? And if we've done it just in the last 40 years, what is it that made that happen? And how the heck can we change it? But what about Barbie?
Yeah, and that's where Kirby Farrell, that's a great segue that you set up, because Kirby Farrell, writing in Psychology Today, he's a PhD, writes about why this is happening. And how about this, James? It's actually the philosophy of consumerism. He looks at Sabrina Corgitelli and her Facebook posts and her what she's talking about in these Facebook posts and how she's trumpeting this kill and how she's posing with this dead giraffe. And what he says is basically, trophy hunting is a bid for heroic self-esteem. You basically, you take your local ego, you get some money, and you go and shoot a prestigious wild beast so that you can create an ad for yourself, that you yourself and this killing of the animal becomes an ad for how awesome you are. And really, she's not a hunter. She's not out there trying to get meat to survive. She's a collector. And what she's trying to do is collect alpha prestige. And as a matter of fact, because of the way she does it, and this is why there's some of the outrage, Kirby says, is because she's not actually out there sport hunting. She's not out there really trying. It's her man against nature. It's like her trying to survive out in the wild, which I think most people, even I would say, if you, it's a matter of your survival. If you are starving and there's a pangolin in front of you and you eat the pangolin, I can't argue with you saving yourself by eating the pangolin. This is actually kind of the natural
good
system.
Point.
The lie is that you get on a plane, you hire a guide, just the way Walter the Killer dentist did, and you basically set the whole thing up in sort of a rarefied environment that allows you to buy the kill, buy the prestige, pose with it, and say, look at me, I'm really awesome. That's consumerism.
For your boyfriend.
Guns, guns, guns.
Eagle all gone and no more caribou.
Guns, guns, guns.
You'll be the Red King, I'll be the Yellow Pawn. Godspeed, Mother Nature. Never really wanted to say goodbye. Godspeed, Mother Nature.
Yes, never wanted to say goodbye. That is the one and only Guess Who. What a great tune, man. That is
an underrated band, I'm telling you.
They really had a lot of concern for the Earth. You know, there was that going around then. It just sort of seemed to go behind the consumerism, didn't it? By the way, what a powerful point, because, you know, we all want to feel good by the clothes we wear, the music we buy, the places we go, the food we eat, the job we have, the church we go to. I mean, that's part of being alive, being proud of who we are, where we're from, what we've got. But that sort of, yeah, very, very interesting, because it is that unbridled part. You know, the Pope didn't say capitalism was bad. He said unbridled capitalism. It's that unbridled. Where does the balance come? That there should be a war on balance. Okay, I'll get off my soapbox. I'm serious, but I'm getting off my soapbox. We're going into the deep dive. Yikes. Labor pains.
Oh, boy.
Okay, my favorite company. Well, I'm not sure which I like more. Zuckerberg, Bezos, or what's his name? Google. Amazonization of everything. Love the word, not so much the concept.
Yeah, you know, we're in a very interesting period here. Labor is changing. Work is changing rapidly. A lot of this is going to be altered by climate because of what's going to happen with climate migration. You know, the workforce here, we've had this recovery for a long time that James, you and I have talked about. And, of course, we had I try to do a labor story or a labor deep dive on those Fridays when we get these labor reports. And the latest labor report is 5.3% unemployment, so everything's kind of steady. Of course, Zero Hedge pointing out that we're still at like an epic high again for number of people not participating in the workforce, right? The workforce participation rate.
Right.
So that's at 62.6%. So you have 93.8 million working age individuals in America not working. You know, the SEC this week adopted a rule, finally part of Dodd-Frank, to force CEOs or corporations to report the average wage from an average worker versus a CEO. It turns out that there are actually CEOs, the number is 300 times, right? Since the crash. Well, there are CEOs making 800 times.
Creepy.
Guys at Chipotle and CVS and Starbucks and Target and Les Moonves is CVS, the pharmacy, and CBS, all 800 times. The winner, by the way, was David Zasloff of Discovery Communications. He makes 2,282 times the average employee at Discovery Communications. That's the media business, folks. That's the media business that I tried to survive in D.C.
Hey, JP, they don't call it the media business for nothing.
I know, my goodness. And then, so what is happening here with labor? What is this about?
Mm-hmm.
And this piece in Jacobin is by David Golumbia is really fascinating. I recommend it as just a read. Just read it. Because it's about this Amazonization of work, which is really just an aspect of something we've talked about, the gig economy, which is taking this labor environment where labor does not have leverage. Unions are gone, but also because of this workforce participation rate, because of underemployment, because of economic boom and bust cycles, labor has lost its ability to wield power. And so what you have is an environment in which corporations, using technology the way Amazon does, is they try to squeeze as much value out of the labor they have as they can, because that's the one part of the means of production that you can really have an effect on. Labor. The cost of labor is something that if you change it, this is why in the 80s when we had that spate of corporate raiders doing takeovers, the first thing that you would do when you bought a company is you fired half of the employees, and all of a sudden the Wall Street said, hey, that's great. You're cutting overhead. The stock price goes up. The raiders sell the stock. They walk away with the money, and bingo, that's what you got. Because things like commodities, although the commodity market is down now, that's harder to manage. Things that other parts of the means of production are not as easy to get an instant bonus out of as labor. And what Amazon is doing, they have this thing called this Echo technology. It's Alexa. It's basically a Siri kind of artificial intelligence personal assistant. They're using that. They're using constant tracking of their employees so that if you're out there working the production line, you're probably either a part-time or a temp worker. You're not actually an employee of Amazon, so they're not fully responsible for you, but you're working in their warehouse and you're being tracked all the time.
Yeah.
So if you are behind schedule by a few seconds, you actually get a text message, an automated text message saying, pick up the pace. So what you see in this Amazonization in this article is that in this economy, what you have is an environment in which corporations are trying to squeeze as much efficiency, in other words, profit, out of the workforce as possible. And because we are now more and more in a gig economy, Thank you, Uber. Thank you, Lyft. You now have a situation in which labor does not have much power to do anything about it. They're even doing it with things like data entry and proofreading. They've created this thing called MTurk. It's a massive pool of people doing data entry. They say you can make up to $25 an hour. No, most people make $5 an hour, far below minimum wage. But because you are a contractor, you are actually exempted from minimum wage requirements. This is where labor is going.
Yeah, what you see is what they get. And, you know, it's corporatist mentality. You get what they're going after. And there's no culture to be able to fight back because of the way the thing shifted. But, you know, when CEOs are getting 800 times or 2,000 times more than their employees, they don't need Viagra to get their bonus, right? All right. Well, here we go on. Next, AI.
You win, James, with that one. You win.
AI-powered assistants step up into the enterprise. Hey, let's automate the repeatables, marginalize the people-bles.
Basically, this is from Computer World. It's a fascinating piece. It's about Amy Ingram. xDoc.ai is a New York company. Amy Ingram is a virtual assistant. She's got a LinkedIn profile, and you can hire her to set up your meetings and send emails for you and so on. Look, this is just like Siri. This is like Alexa, which is Amazon's personal assistant, artificial intelligence assistant. All I'm going to say is this. There's one analyst here who said virtual assistants are laying the foundation for a mind-blowing artificial intelligence invasion that are dramatically impacting life, business, and the greater economy. This is what's coming, folks. Automation is here. All of that science fiction is here. It's happening. And this is another wage pressure that's going to be put on labor.
Look at the way the stock market's traded now. Anyway, how smuggled workers power Made in China and the other Chinese story. We'll be talking about fascinating stuff about where they're finding their cheap labor.
And why did I put these together? Because this is like a pincher action. You have two things happening. You have this massive growth and development in artificial intelligence and robotics, and you also have a massive pool of cheap labor migrants and immigrants that is being exploited. And here's the fascinating thing about China. China now, and Reuters went to 6 factory towns in the southern part of China. They, because wages have actually grown in China over the last 5 years, I think they've gone up like 2 plus times in 5 years to $450 per month. That's for a worker. That's more than doubled in the last 5 years. Because of this, and because China's factory sector is flagging, because their $2.3 trillion export market is flagging, which is something that James and I, you and I, have talked about a lot. I'm a big believer that if you want to look at the health of the world's economy, you look at China. That's where you look. And because Americans who are being impacted on the wage and the wage part of their wage packets cannot go out and consume plastic stuff in China. China now, with their wage growth over the last 5 years, is looking for ways to cut their labor costs. So they're importing people from Myanmar and Vietnam and Laos. So now there's a massive trade in illicit migrant labor coming into Chinese markets to fill low-wage jobs that Chinese are not filling to try and increase profitability, because their profitability is being undercut by the fact that things like automation and the decline of manufacturing in America and the outsourcing of jobs back to China has gutted the ability of American consumers to buy plastic stuff from China.
It's such a cycle that it's like, if you take one step back, it's like, wow, are we really doing this? But to see, I love to see whatever our type of predatory capitalism is, whatever it is, and whatever theirs is, communist capitalism, same issues, same things tried to. And also, JP, I get such a kick out of the economy, the stock market there on the edge of the abyss, and everything thrown at it. It seems to be okay. Nobody even talks about it again. A few people here and there. But anyway, what about this other one? Where are they getting their labor?
Well, now China, because of cheap cotton, cheap natural gas, because of tax incentives in the South, because the South is the home of some of the cheapest labor in America, they are now moving some of their textile productions to America. Well, sort of. They're moving the production of yarn to America. And there's basically now, in terms of manufacturing, for every buck in America, it's 96 cents in China. Now, that 4 cents seems like a little bit on sort of large economies of scale. You know, that can turn into a profitable margin. But in terms of just producing yarn, China says, hey, let's go to America. And as one commentator pointed out, it's because there's an equilibrium starting to develop between the two labor markets, folks. Wow. America and China, together forever. But here's a funny thing. Still, the actual sewing of the garments has to go overseas because that's too labor intensive.
Interesting. What about, you're a big company, you want to cut some more, the way you keep your profits up, buying your own stock, but also finding places to cut. What's GE doing?
GE found $3.3 billion in savings by cutting retiree benefits.
Huh.
Boom. That's it. And so what they're doing is they are leveraging the Health Care Act, Obamacare, to cut retiree health benefits to increase profitability. Like, this is like, you can read this whole thing. It's very interesting about how they're phasing out. And they're not the only ones. You also have other companies, Time Warner and Walgreens, they're all doing this now. They're basically offloading their retirement promises to the federal government, which is one of the reasons why it got passed in the first place, folks. They are increasing profitability, but I think the big takeaway here, James, is corporations in this. I've said this for a while. The contemporary form, the kind of capitalism that we've all been living with, ended in 2008, and it's basically going to take about a decade to two decades, three decades maybe total, for it to play out. But what you see is a desire and a reach for yield to squeeze out value anywhere they can. Corporate planners, they don't have demand, they don't have a thriving economy, they have to squeeze value out and cut corners wherever possible, and retiree health benefits is one of the ways.
I wonder if the invisible hand's going to find himself in the unemployment line sometime. Anyway, the future of work, with us or against us?
This is just, you want to check this out. This is about whether robotics are going to help or not going to help. There are two sides of the question. This is a great piece by Pacific Standard. You know, is it going to, of course, the International Robotics Foundation says it's going to create a whole new booming economy. Critics, like Moshe Vardy of Rice University, says, not so much. Virtually all the labor that's currently being done by humans is going to be within reach of robots and artificial intelligence within the next 15 to 20 years.
Well, maybe the robots can be turned into shepherds for the unicorns. Okay. How to live happily with robots. That's what I'm getting to.
You're on fire. Jeffrey Sachs writes an interesting piece in the American Prospect. Jeffrey Sachs, wunderkind, economist for many years, one of the guys who led the austerity drive in the post-Soviet Union Eastern Bloc during the Clinton administration, ended up repenting for that. Now he's trying to champion sustainability around the world. He's actually says he regrets what happened to Russia in the 90s at his guidance. And in here, he's talking about how automation is going to play out. Basically, automation is going to help the people who own the automation, the capitalists, and the highest skilled workers. Everybody else is going to pay a price. The only way for automation to have a positive effect is, according to Sachs, is if governments redistribute the wealth that's created by automation, redistribute the benefits. Basically, you have to get rid of the plutocracy, take over the democracy, and redistribute the benefits. Otherwise, we're all going to be stuck in a robotic cage.
We'll be right back. solar-powered Crew FM.
Oh, yeah. Well, thank you, Mark. Mother's Bought a little Devo there. Gates of Steel, Men of Steel. Oh, my goodness. Steel Magnolias. Let's bust. It's time to go all odds and ends and good news. Quick hits here, folks. JP, it's great to hear your voice again. Happy birthday last week, and I hope you had a good celebration. Radio audience hits all-time high. Whoa.
It keeps spiking. Nielsen reported 245 million Americans tuned in the second quarter of 2015. That was Americans age 12 and up. Radio, baby.
Radio killed the video star. No, wait, it's the other way. Okay, a demolished Palestinian village comes back to life. Yes.
Yes, demolished Christian village of Ikrit in 1948, demolished by troops purging Palestinians, Israeli troops purging Palestinians. They're actually going to be on the Israeli power grid.
Interesting. All right, in other good news, our final story, why are Americans switching to renewable energy? Well, for the best reason, right?
Because it's cheaper. It's more cost-effective. It takes $6 to $8 million to dig a shale well, and then it dries up. Guess what, folks? The sun and the wind, it ain't going anywhere.
Isn't that great? It makes sense, folks. Okay, odds and
ends. Dollars and cents.
The war was won before Hiroshima, and the generals who dropped the bomb knew it. This is some sobering stuff. You know what, JP? It's changing. It's not conspiracy theorist stuff. I think
That's right.
Maybe as the greatest generation is sort of, you know, going on to the great beyond more and more, nothing against them. It was just something that was fed, spoon-fed, silver-fed, that it was given as a faith article of faith.
Yeah, and this great piece by Gar Alperovitz, who has been doing this story for a long time. I happen to have a master's degree in focusing on the history of Imperial Japan. Folks in the English language world of the history of Japan know that the bombs did not need to be dropped, that surrender was there. The key thing supposedly holding up the surrender was that America said, you can't keep the emperor. By the way, after Nagasaki, when Hirohito said, no, I cannot do it anymore, I am abdicating, the Americans accepted the surrender and said, no, you have to stay.
Yeah, no, it's breaking the codes, knowing what was going on. Another great piece, why couldn't they have dropped that bomb in Tokyo Harbor, although having killed 250,000 in the spring?
This was a demonstration to the world and specifically to Russia, and also to make sure that Russia would not occupy key northern islands in the Japanese chain. It was about the Soviet Union, folks.
Yep. And some say, well, you know, maybe that sacrifice was worth it. If you ever feel that way, think of what that means or says. Science's gender gap is worse than you thought.
Because most of the animal testing is done on male mice. And it turns out that males feel pain differently than females, so all the results are skewed.
Wow, interesting. Unbeknownst to Richard Dawkins, the feminist revolution in Islam has already begun.
Yeah, Richard, I've actually listened to Ziba Al-Husseini and looked at the Sisters of Islam. There is an attempt. He says, Islam needs a feminist revolution. Well, you know what? There are people trying to do it. They need allies, not critics.
There you go. Why rich Americans thought it was a good idea to lend billions to Puerto Rico? Hedge fund.
Because it was tax-free, baby.
Hedge fund. Tax shelter. Bond. Yep. Get rid of the schools. 100 of them already
and
down.
Now that there's $70 billion of debt, the hedge funds say, oh, just close your schools.
30 miles from Selma, a different kind of civil rights struggle.
Yeah, there's this thing called the Black Belt in Alabama. It's where all of these waste dumps and municipal dumps are formed. There's a 1,000 square acre dump that was planned. Local black community said, please don't do it. It was approved anyway. It's environmental racism, folks.
Wow. All right. Well, feeling small in the face of nature makes people feel more generous.
Yeah, Paul Piff, a psychology professor at UC Irvine, ran an experiment where they exposed people to pictures from BBC's great series Planet Earth, wonderful high-def pictures of all kinds of things. It's really a beautiful series. I've watched it. And he said by diminishing the emphasis on the individual self, awe may encourage people to forego strict self-interest and to participate in helping the welfare of others. Guess what? The people who looked at these pictures, these BBC Earth pictures of volcanoes and canyons and schools of fish, suddenly, after given a test, the test revealed they wanted to be more generous.
Well, just think if you actually went by the ocean or to one of those places. I always find it very, refreshing and centering to be by the ocean.
Yeah, a little different than the consumerism impulse that causes you to want to pose with a trophy.
Or narcissize your life away for Mr. Zuckerberg's benefit. Why the long face, mister? Horses and humans share facial expressions.
Just more reason why we should put the horse before Descartes.
All right, you got me there. Oh, man, it must be weekend coming up. You might be eating more plastic than you think. Yikes, don't like that.
Yeah, when you wash your wonderful fleece sweater or jacket, and all of a sudden microfibers, artificial microfibers that don't break down, go into the water system. They pick up toxins. They go up the food chain, and then you eat the tuna. And guess what? You're eating the toxic effects of your own microfibers, folks.
Seems to be a weird justice in that, but I have to say, plastic, not so fantastic here. How about I feed once a week the real-life vampires of, I don't know why I'm doing Arnold Schwarzenegger, of Atlanta.
Because this one is just crazy. This is in Daily Beast. It's about censors on Mertikus, who came out of the coffin in 1997 and ID'd himself as a vampire, as vampiric. There's a thing called vampire personality disorder. The Atlanta Vampire Alliance gets vampires together with the people who like to donate blood to them. And this is a real thing, folks.
Well, if we want to suck your blood, sweat, and tears, speaking of blood, sweat, and tears, what about sex, drugs, and rock and roll? What about them animals? They got any of that stuff going?
Hey, leave it to the French and the folks at Le Monde to write a wonderful piece about bonobos who like to get it on with anybody at any time and do just about anything, about elephants in 1998 that stormed a rice wine deposit. They stormed it, they got the rice wine, and then they rampaged. Basically, animals, folks, they're just like you. They like to party. Animals are people too, and they're party animals.
They're all animals, JP.
We're all animals, baby. Let's party.
Anyway, it is good to hear your voice. Folks, it's a happy hour time, and you know what?
Sex and drugs and rock and roll.
That's what I'm talking about.
It's all my brain and body need. Sex and drugs and rock and roll. It's very good indeed. Keep your silly ways, or throw them out the window. The wisdom of your ways, I've been there and I know. Lots of other ways, what a jolly bad show. If all you ever do is business you don't like. Sex and drugs and rock and roll. Sex and drugs and rock and roll. Sex and drugs and